This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people, places, and food of Southern California. I'm Mona Holmes, in for Steve Chiotakis, and today we're going on a journey to a farmer's market.
Tomatoes look so good.
Here's your tomato, Big Bird.
Oh, well, here's some money.
Thank you.
Did you ever wonder where all this food comes from? Well, I'll tell you, it comes from out of cans, bottles, and boxes. Right, guys?
No!
Oh, I know. It comes from the supermarkets.
No!
The stork brings them?
No! They come from our farm!
Your farm?
Big Bird was just learning about the farm to farmer's market pipeline. Yeah, okay. You've heard of farm to table, but do you really know how your food gets from the farm and onto your plate? This is what I like to call the journey to the plate. For us Angelenos, a lot of our food comes from our own backyard, Ventura, San Diego, and even the Coachella Valley. Take the avocado. Before it ends up a part of that delicious avocado toast, it starts on a tree, probably in Ventura County. But instead of me explaining it to you, I'll have these folks do it. Chris Sayer is the manager of Petty Ranch. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Mona.
Patrick Cortez is the Senior Director of Business Development and Food Service at Mission Produce. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Mona. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And Evan Fox is the owner and founder of the fleet of Yeasty Boys Bagels food trucks. Welcome, Evan.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Very good. Let's jump right in. Chris, I want to start with you as the farmer in the group. Before our beloved avocado toast hits the table, it actually starts with you at Petty Ranch in Ventura County. So I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about the ranch and why avocados are so special to Southern California.
Well, our ranch has been in the family for a little over 130 years. I'm really fortunate to be the fifth generation of my family to be growing here. And avocados are something we've grown since the 1950s, although really it's only been in the last 10 years that they've displaced lemons as our primary crop, and one that we expect to be doing a lot more of in the future.
And tell me about how many avocados you grow and distribute every season.
So this year was a new high water mark for us. We grew about 185,000 pounds of avocados. But we've got a lot of acreage that's still young and not yet producing. So I hope in a few years when we revisit this issue, I'll be able to say that we've hit the 500,000 pound mark. That's our goal.
Yeah, I hear that. Now, I know there are different kinds of avocados, but what kind specifically do you grow?
So we grow the Hass, which is the one that most everybody's familiar with, since that's about 95% of the U.S. market. But we also have a fair amount of our acreage in a variety called Lamb Hass, which looks very similar. It's just a little bit larger, and it comes off a little bit later in the season.
Got it. And shout out to everyone who's been mispronouncing Hass all this time, yours truly included. and also tell me, is there a season for avocados in California? When do they actually become the best?
So I would say that Hass generally are going to be at the peak, May, June, into July a little bit. The Lambs tend to be better July, August, September. So it's really tends to be a summertime crop in California, although they can be harvested, depending on variety, almost 12 months out of the year. Mm. But we're definitely, 90%+ in the spring and summer in terms of what we actually send to market.
Okay, got it. And if it's not from California, where would the majority also come from?
So most of the avocados in the U.S. today come from Mexico. But we're starting to see some other players start to send avocados into the U.S. market. Peru has started to become a much more significant player, as well as Chile. So Mexico certainly has the lion's share. And these days, even California finds ourselves sort of a small player within the market here in the U.S. that we helped create.
Now, we also have heard, I mean, everyone has heard at one time or another, where there aren't enough avocados or there's too many of them. We can see them in the grocery store when all of a sudden there's like five for $2. And then all of a sudden the price fluctuates. Can you explain a little bit of why that is?
Sure. There are two primary reasons. One is that the avocado tree itself is very prone to what's called alternate bearing. So if it has a heavy crop one year, it's going to have a very light crop the next. So you get this oscillation in the supply year after year. The other component of it, though, is that a lot of the avocados coming in from Mexico, from Peru, from Chile, we don't have as much insight into their actual production. And so we tend to get a little bit surprised sometimes by new fruit coming into the market. So for most of this year, avocado deliveries into the United States were running about 40, 45 million pounds. And usual American demand is about 50 million pounds a week. So during those periods of time, really up until the middle of July, prices tended to be very high. Once we got past the middle of July and you started to see the second Mexican crop and the Peruvian crop come in, suddenly we started seeing imports running around 60 million pounds a week, and now prices are much, much lower. So you've got this combination of both the plant and then just the market and the insight into the different sources that creates that fluctuation in supply, and then the price follows that.
Mm. Now, I'd like to bring Patrick into the conversation. Now, once the avocados leave a farm like Chris's at Petty Ranch, they might head to you at Mission Produce to get distributed. So tell us what happens next.
Yeah, so we bring in avocados from many growers around the state, including Chris's farm. They come into our packing facility, which is in Oxnard, California, and from there, based on the sizing and the demand, we pack the avocados in multiple different presentations, from a traditional 25-pound cardboard box to plastic containers, put them into bags, whatever a end customer, i.e. retailer or food service operator, might be looking for. And from there, we put them into finished goods and distribute California, primarily Rocky Mountains West, and have a varied amount of programs. We have a lot of customers that want ripe avocados, because we've found over the years that when we deliver ripe avocados, the consumer by and large takes them home, eats them a lot more quickly, and then we'll head back to the grocery store to buy more. So a lot of it depends on what the customer needs and where we're looking to go with it once it comes into our pack house.
So I would imagine that during like events like the Super Bowl or the 4th of July or any one of those events where guacamole might be a in demand on different tables, that winds up affecting your business pretty significantly.
Yeah, a great observation for sure. We call them the avocado holidays, right? And Super Bowl is the king of our avocado holidays, as well as Cinco de Mayo, the 4th of July, and then smaller ones to a lesser extent. But yeah, anytime there are big gatherings, that's definitely when we will see a strong uptick in demand across the country and in California for that matter.
Mm. Now, I've noticed that avocados, in my whole life of shopping in Los Angeles for food, I've noticed that avocados are better from some stores than others. Now, is there an actual difference in buying your avocados from a Whole Foods, a Trader Joe's, my local Mexican market, a Super King? Is there any difference in finding better quality ones at those stores?
You know, the differences that you're going to find from one grocery store or retail chain to another, a lot are going to be dependent on their supply chain. You know, for example, take Mission Produce. The way we handle the avocados from the farms that we partner with in California, that process is the same regardless of farm, regardless of location. It's all about cold chain. It's all about maintaining the proper standards and how we ripen the fruit and how we deliver to various retail chains across the state. And then from there, every retailer will have a different set of protocols. So anytime you see that at the actual store shelf, a lot of that will be just the nuances that would be within specific chains from one to another.
Okay, excellent. Now, Evan, now that the avocado has left the distribution center, it might head to one of your food trucks where you serve tons of avocados. So how many do you sell within a week?
I would say between like a 5-day period, Wednesday through Sunday, we go through anywhere from like 175 to like 225.
And then for you, I would imagine, as someone who struggles with the ripening process at home with avocados, how do you keep them from going bad? How do you get them to ripen? How do you keep waste, massive waste, from becoming a problem?
It's interesting because, and I actually just spoke to my manager about this earlier this week, is like, we don't really have a spoilage issue. Our issue mostly is ripening. So, you know, we have to space these things out, how we buy them and slowly kind of integrate them in our trucks because, yeah, like they don't really go bad. It's the issue of do they ripen? So the way we really get these going, I would say, is we have different techniques. Usually, just honestly, we keep them in a dry, sort of warm place in a brown bag. We keep them with bananas, but yeah, it's really just about spacing the product out because we can like churn through these things like real quick. So spoilage really with these things are not the issue. It's just like, do we buy them ripe? And that's been like the bane of my existence since I've been open.
And has that always been the case? I mean, have you adjusted how you make this approach?
Yeah, like so throughout the years, we've definitely gotten like avocados that, you know, I'd buy a box of like 48 avocados from, you know, like a grocery chain, and they would never turn ripe. And I'm so it's like so confusing on why that would be. They're all really hard. And so there's different people that we go to now to get really nice product. You know, we use a produce market downtown that gets us like the perfectly ripe avocados. And I have more questions than I do answers because I'm always kind of curious about how they get those to be perfectly ripe.
And then you are in the bagel business,
Yes.
but but how important are avocados to your day-to-day business?
I would say very important. They're like the perfect add-on to any bagel sandwich. I also think that like bagel, you know, avocado toast is sort of its own genre now at this point. And so, you know, it's almost a product line in itself. So I'd say avocados, very important. And there was a period a few years ago where you would go to this grocery and there would be just a huge hole in the avocado section. I don't know if that people were on strike or what, but you know, we definitely got a lot of complaints during that period.
Before I let you all go, I want to ask you, what is so special about the California avocado? Why can't folks seem to get enough of them? Why now?
Yeah, I think one of the things which makes avocado special to so many people, and at the risk of sounding corny, is that it really captures for a lot of people. I think a lot of just this idea of what they think of as being best about California, it gets consumed year round, but people think of it as summertime. They think of it, you know, as you know, great food and, you know, guacamole or sliced avocados on whether it's toast or bagels or sandwiches. It's just becoming a lot more versatile, a lot more accepted. And, you know, it just is one of those things which people seem to have a love for them that just seems to go beyond easy description.
Patrick?
Yeah, I think the evolution of the avocado has really been a fascinating case study. And much like Chris said, I think it begins with the origin here in California. And then the evolution of just the versatility that the avocado brings. And we've just seen it over the years how what Californians have known forever is creeping out not through the rest of the United States, but the rest of the world. And it's becoming more and more ubiquitous across all cuisines. And then you throw in the health aspects, you throw in its crossover into pop culture. I think it's definitely the belle of the ball, so to speak. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it is basically universal when it comes to our food system. And California, as the origin, as where it all started, has to be thanked for that. And I think we're only going to continue to see that popularity grow as it's done for the last 25 plus years.
Evan.
You know, I think it's just an integral part of our culture now at this point. Like, avocados are everywhere. It's people are making oils, people are cooking with them more and more. I don't remember, you know, 15 years ago, it, you know, didn't seem like they were as huge as they are now, but now it's on every menu. I think with California avocados, a lot of it also has to do with flavor. They have a unique flavor to them, more so than the other avocados that I've tried.
Chris Sayer is the manager of Petty Ranch. Patrick Cortez is Senior Director of Business Development and Food Service at Mission Produce. And Evan Fox is the owner and founder of Yeasty Boys Bagels. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Mona.
My pleasure, Mona. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, how does a restaurant make great sustainable food, pay and treat people decently, and not charge an arm and a leg? Back with more Greater LA after this quick break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Greater LA. I'm Mona Holmes. Earlier, we spoke about how food gets to your table. Now let's look at how one local restaurant is taking a different approach to pricing, sustainability, and staffing. Rather than the typical 5 or 6 day work weeks of many restaurants, the staff at Santa Monica restaurant Crudo y Nudo work 4 10-hour days. The restaurant has no investors, a small focused menu, and a profit margin that's 3 times higher than the industry standard goal of 10%. Here to talk to us about how all this works are the owners of Crudo y Nudo, Lena Colain and Brian Bornman. Lena, Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Excellent. Let's start with your business model. Let's talk about what it looks like on the ground, because it's not your typical restaurant structure, correct?
No, not at all. You know, we really have tried to think through kind of how to sell food and beverage in a new way that works in this day and age. And I think having been in a lot of different restaurants, you know, myself in a lot of managerial roles and Lena in a lot of roles as well, you know, you see the total amount of work that has to be done. And normally that's kind of assigned out to one manager or a manager and a chef. And it's really an overwhelming amount of duties. Whereas we just kind of took what we loved and what's important in order to sell like really high quality food well, and kind of eliminated and stripped away all the rest, and kind of dispersed things out so that no one person is working more than 40 hours a week. And it is, you know, a lot of work when you're there, but you know, we expect that people get some real time and relaxation, and thankfully, because of the pandemic, I think we were able to do something very different.
Mm. So let's also talk about where you're located. You're in an affluent area, Santa Monica. Do you feel like that also helps make your approach successful? And also, do you believe that this structure might be viable for lower priced restaurants in less affluent parts of Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think that there are many restaurants already that kind of work with a similar take on this model. It's just normally a lower price point, let's say like sandwiches and salads or kind of a deli counter situation. I do think though that with the right type of, I don't know, just culinary knowledge or expertise, you can take things that provide good margins and good return and, you know, a good check average regardless of what the ingredient is, and still structure it in a way that runs with a leaner staff that then allows you to pay them all equitably.
Mm. Lena, I'd love to hear from you. That, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think that, you know, more and more businesses are really taking this inspiring approach of creating co-ops and profit-sharing models, which is something that we're actively pursuing now in New York. But I also think that, you know, Brian and I feel very lucky to live in Santa Monica and to work where we live. We wanted to start our business where we live. And it just so happens that the products that we love to sell are also from the very nearby community. So we just feel like we kind of hit the jackpot in that sense.
You've talked about making sure that food and beverage prices are accurate representations of what they cost, but we're all feeling inflation and rising prices are happening all around us. So how do you make sure that your customers will feel it when they're paying the check? I mean, the thing that I've noticed most is a rise in customer complaints about higher costs at local restaurants. So how do you address that?
Well, we do. We offer a lunch special during the week from 12 to 2 that has a much lower sort of barrier to entry to experience what Crudo is about with seafood and vegetable options. And then, Brian, if you want to speak to some of the other points.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's important for us is the way that we source, coming from farmers and fishermen that are doing things in the right way, is like really the goal. It's supporting food that's local, that's the lowest carbon footprint possible, and that's like really done well. And unfortunately, costs are going up for farmers and fishermen too. To us, it's, you know, I think restaurants classically have had to like play this middleman where you're trying to like get the lowest price ingredient possible or the best margin possible to sell at a decent price. But you know, I think we're in a unique situation in Los Angeles where there are many restaurants and there are many places that you can go for food. And so I think the bigger goal of what we're doing is to like take stuff that we know is really direct from the best source possible and represent it in a way that's so delicious and so craveable that, you know, hopefully people don't mind paying what they are paying because they know exactly where it's going. They know exactly how many hands have touched it. And they know they're not, you know, they're supporting something outside of the commercial industrial complex and really are putting money into the right pockets, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And because you're both restaurant veterans, I want to take advantage of having you both here to talk about this. I wonder if having worked in high profile spots help shape your approach when you built this restaurant? And also, what were some of your takeaways as far as what not to do when you set out on your own?
I was really lucky to be part of an opening team of a restaurant in Nashville called Folk. And that's where I really cut my teeth, I think, in learning about how good hospitality feels, not just how it looks, not just like what the rules are, sort of the etiquette of running a great restaurant and having an incredible food and beverage program, but what are sort of these like behind the curtain details of how you feel when you walk in. Like, we wanted our restaurants to feel like you were coming to our house. And I think, you know, even though we're in two parking spots outside in Santa Monica, when you come inside, you know, you're greeted by people who are really passionate and really focused on what we're trying to accomplish and who are dedicated to making the experience something that is really holistic. It's not just like one or two points. It's how you feel from the start to the finish, how you feel taken care of, how you feel connected to what we're doing. And I think a big part of that is because we started in a pandemic where so many people were disconnected.
One thing that every chef I've spoken with over the last 2 years has told me, and even pre-COVID, has said that turnover is a huge problem. Do you find that your approach is helping you hold on to staff? I mean, what is your turnover like?
Yeah. I think that this kind of goes hand in hand with what Lena was just talking about conveniently, in that because we designed it, you know, we honestly picked the spot thinking, you know, this is pre-vaccine, thinking worst case scenario, if everything goes south, Lena and I can work this spot by ourselves. And unfortunately, it did come to that again in the first surge of Omicron. But the overall thought is like, with less square footage to cover and a really high quality product, we can attract the type of staff that are really motivated to do something different, be part of something different, and like feel passionately about that. It's different to hire a bunch of people to fill roles. I need this many bussers, I need this many dishwashers, I need this many runners, than it is to just hire people who are committed to hopefully building a better future and then creating the roles around them.
Lena Colleen, Brian Bornman, owners of Crudo y Nudo, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Mona. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having us. We're big fans.
That's the show for today. Next week, remembering the Chicano moratorium, the pay struggles of LA's garment workers, and working the Venice boardwalk. Also, Greater LA wants to hear from you for a future segment on the show. The Biden administration has announced it's canceling up to $20,000 in student loan debt. How will that plan change your life? Will it change the financial decisions you make? Let us know. Send your thoughts by email to studentloans@kcrw.org. That's studentloans@kcrw.org. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, Amy Taub, Mike Vogel, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordel all made today's episode happen. I'm Mona Holmes. This has been amazing. Thank you for listening.